Merrick Krokos, who's with us tonight to speak in our series, The Fragile Planet. And he's going to be talking about fragile oceans. Merrick's a professor of physical oceanography at the National Oceanographic Centre in Southampton. And formerly, well, as part-time, wasn't it? You were also at the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion in Cambridge, a busy man. Merrick obtained his PhD in applied mathematics at Bristol University in 1988, and during his time in Bristol, he was part of this church, and he helped with pathfinders, and he just informed me that he broke his ankle whilst doing pathfinder things 3 weeks before his wedding, so he had to go down the aisle with a plaster. So he's got fond memories of Redland. But his PhD was on theoretical modelling of wave power devices, apparently. He subsequently worked at the Institute of Oceanographic Studies, studying breaking waves. That sounds like a band or something, breaking waves. I like that, yeah. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, he spent some time with the British National Space Centre, working on remote sensing of the oceans. And then since 1997, he's been based in Southampton at the National Oceanographic Centre. In 2001, he became the science coordinator for the Rapid Climate Change Programme, which focuses on studying the role of the North Atlantic in possible future rapid changes in the climate. And he's not just a scientist. In 2005, he obtained a BA in theology, so he's a very rounded individual. He is also an author, and he has his book here. It's called Blue Planet, Blue God, The Bible and the Sea. So you can see he's well equipped for tonight's talk. And he has it on special offer there for £13, down from 19, is it?
£19.99,
an even better deal. So without further ado, Merrick, it's a delight to have you here. We look forward to what you've got to say, and hopefully the technology won't give up on us.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. Thank you, Tina, too. It's a pleasure to be here. It's particularly a pleasure to be in Redland because I have many happy memories. We were in the church here. My wife and I met when we were students in Bristol. We got married here in the church. I with a broken leg because of the Pathfinder disaster of playing rounders, a very violent game. Anyway, moving on to something more serious. I'm going to talk to you about our fragile oceans, caring for the oceans. I'm not going to cover everything to do with oceans that we could do because that would take forever. And anyway, I've written a book about it, so by the book. I am going to talk about some specific aspects, but before I start talking, I want to test you with a little quiz. So, there are three pictures here, A, B, and C. Now, I want you to think for about 30 seconds, which is the odd one out and why? So, which is the odd one? We'll vote in a minute, so we'll vote. Well, I won't vote, you'll vote, to say which one is the odd one out. Is it A, B, or C, and why is that the odd one out? So, I'll just give you 30 seconds to think about that, and then we'll see what you come up with. Okay, your 30 seconds is up, so now we're going to vote. Who thinks A is the odd one out? Oh, a sprinkling. Oh, no, quite a few. That's good. Interesting. B? C? Oh, C wins. So let's start with the C answers. The people who voted C, anybody care to say why they think it's the odd one out?
There's no C in C.
There's no C in C. That's true, yeah. Good answer, yes. Yeah, that's a good answer as well. Yep. Okay, so that's two good answers. Let's go to B. Who voted for B? Why B?
Because there's no communication in B.
What are you saying about me, Peter? That's a younger version of me on the back of our ship. Any other comments on B? What about A? Who voted for A? Why is that one the other note?
Maybe oceanographers don't actually do that.
That is, in fact, the correct answer, Tina. Well done. The reason A is the odd one out is because when I say I'm an oceanographer, most people think that's to do with swimming with whales and dolphins, because they've watched David Attenborough's Blue Planet, or if you're my sort of generation, you probably watched Jacques Cousteau many years ago. So people tend to think of oceanography as to do with swimming with whales and dolphins, and in fact, actually that's not. Me in the orange suit is on the back of our research vessel when I was younger. The reason I'm wearing the orange suit is it's a survival suit. If you fall in the North Atlantic, your survival time is minutes because of the temperature. It's cold. And also the point of it being... So the survival suit will let you survive for longer. The point of it being orange is hopefully they'll spot you in the water, because they're actually quite difficult to spot things in the water. So hopefully if you fall in and you're orange, they'll find you. Not that I've ever fallen in. And we haven't actually ever lost an oceanographer at sea. And the final one is also at sea. It's my colleague Katya. We were doing some computer modelling on the ship. So we were connecting the data and putting it into a model and trying to understand it as we were going along making the measurements. So I am a physical oceanographer. That means I'm interested in the physics of the oceans. I don't swim with whales and dolphins. So what I want to do is to put the context of what I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm going to talk about some oceanography, but I'm also going to talk a bit about an understanding of Scripture. And my understanding of Scripture starts with what I would call God's story and the Earth story, the big story of the Scriptures, which is the Bible is really about God. But embedded in Scripture is the story of the Earth. And in Genesis 1:1, it says, "In the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth." And then at the end, in Revelation 21:1, it says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth." So the earth's story is embedded in the story of God in Scripture. And we're living in the middle, and we are affecting the earth's story. And we need to think about what that means for us as Christians. As an oceanographer, I'm very encouraged by this verse in Genesis, which talks about gathering the waters together in one place and calling them the seas, and God saying it was good. So I'm encouraged that I'm studying a good part of God's creation, and it's a fun thing to do. And I can find other verses in the Bible which speak to me of my experience. This is one from Psalm 104. "There is a vast and there is the sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both large and small. Their ships go to and fro, and the Leviathan which you formed to frolic there." So that's one of our ships outside the Oceanography Centre in Southampton. So we go to and fro on the sea quite a lot. And the top picture is taken in a Force 11 storm in the North Atlantic. We had 12-metre waves. That's not entirely obvious from the picture. So we were bouncing around in our small tin research vessel. And this pod of pilot whales, it was difficult to count, probably about 30 or 40 of them, including baby whales, came along and surfed, body surfed the breaking waves around the ship. It was an amazing sight. But it made me think of this verse, you know, Leviathan, which could be in this context a whale, but could be something else. But anyway, just remind me of this verse. "You formed to frolic there." They were frolicking. They were enjoying being in the ocean. They were enjoying what they were doing in a way that we in our tin can, feeling rather uncomfortable being bounced around words. So what I'm going to talk about tonight, if I've got enough time, I'm not sure how much of this I'll get through, is I'm going to talk about the oceans and climate. And I've sort of subtitled that, "What Will Happen the Day After Tomorrow?" And the reason for that subtitle will become apparent shortly. And then I'm going to talk a bit about the oceans and plastics, because it's fairly topical. And then I'm going to come back to looking at what the Scriptures say and how we should respond. So just to give you a sort of a feel for why the oceans are important in climate, first of all, the top 3 meters of the ocean contain as much heat as the entire atmosphere. And that's because the thermal capacity of water is much higher than the thermal capacity of air, so they can hold a lot more heat. And the oceans are 4 kilometers deep. So the ocean holds a tremendous amount of heat. If we had no ocean, you do a rough of back-of-the-envelope calculation, given the amount of carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere, the planet would have warmed by several degrees, and I'll come back to this point later. Most of that heat has gone into the ocean. And the ocean modifies climate over long periods of time because it interacts with the atmosphere, it exchanges heat and moisture with the atmosphere, and the ocean circulation moves heat over larger distances. So, for example, in the North Atlantic, the ocean is releasing a petawatt of heat to the atmosphere, which is 10 to the 15 watts continuously. That is 30,000 times the output of all the UK power stations put together. So I'll come back to this point as well later. So let's just talk a bit about what I'm involved in, which is rapid climate change and where the ocean fits into that. Now, we know something about past climate from things like ice cores. If you drill an ice core in somewhere like Greenland or Antarctica, it's got layers, just like tree rings. These go back, in Greenland's case, to about 120,000 years. In Antarctica, almost to 1 million years. and you can count them. And the layers, the water in the layers, you can measure the oxygen isotope, oxygen 18, oxygen 16 is the usual one, and the ratio of oxygen 16 to oxygen 18, which is called delta 18O, can be calibrated to be a measure of temperature. I won't go into the technical details of that, but it can be done. And then if you look at the ice cores at the bottom line, you can see the microscopic views of the ice cores show ice crystals trapped prehistoric air bubbles. So you can actually analyse the air in these bubbles, which comes from 100,000, 200,000, so many years ago, and you can see how much carbon dioxide there was in the atmosphere. So you can get a feel for past climate, both in terms of temperature and in terms of CO2. So this graph, the present day is at this end, zero, and this is from Antarctica, so it goes back about 400,000 years, and the blue line is the temperature. It's in degrees Fahrenheit because it's an American colleague who provided the graph. That's not particularly critical. The point is you can see the ice ages, and you can see that at the present day at zero, we've got a fairly warm climate. I mean, it's around zero because it's in Antarctica, but it's warm relative to the past. And you can see that the carbon dioxide going up and down is related, or the temperature is related to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And we are pushing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and that's going up. And you can see the CO2 at the present day is just over 400 parts per million by volume, and it's going to keep going up if we keep burning fossil fuels like oil and gas and coal. So we are pushing the system, and we should expect the system to respond. This is the same thing from Greenland, just to show that same thing. So this is only 100,000 years. This time, present day is at this end. And you can see the last 10,000 years, which is the Holocene period, is a very stable climate compared to the past. All of recorded human history exists in that little bit of the record. We are living in a very comfortable part of the climate system compared to what it has been like in the past. But we are messing with the climate by pumping a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And where the oceans come in is when you compare the record. So the top line is the Greenland ice core. Again, the paleoceanographers seem to swap their scales backwards and forwards. So present day is at this end again, zero. And the top line is the Greenland ice core again. And the bottom line is a measure of lightness, of colour of the sediments in the ocean. Now, the sediments are formed by plankton that die and end up in the sediments. And there are plankton that have calcium carbonate shells, and they're temperature dependent, so you can link what's happening in the ocean to what's happening in the ice core, and you can see that there are oscillations in the ocean which are linked to the ice core oscillations. And the theory is, or our understanding is, that the changes in the ocean can change the temperatures globally. And the reason that we're concerned is, if you go back to that graph I showed with the CO2, is that over the last 100, 200 years, we've been putting a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere as we've even been industrializing oil, gas, coal. And you can see this is a record from Hawaii, Manoa Loa Observatory, very classic. It's called the Keeling Curve. And we've just exceeded 400 parts per million. And that was last exceeded about 3 million years ago. 3 million years ago, there weren't human beings to worry about this. Not human beings like we are today, of course. And you can see in the curve, the little oscillations, the curve that's not smooth, but the oscillations, is just the seasonal changes, because the northern hemisphere, because Hawaii's in the northern hemisphere, breathe in the spring, you know, when plants grow, they take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and then when they decay in the autumn, they release it back. So you have a seasonal cycle in the CO2, as well as the increase. So, oops, just a minute. Let's just stop that. Let's go back. I should say. Now I'm going to show you the trailer for a film called The Day After Tomorrow. This is how Hollywood sees what I do. So I thought you might be interested to see Hollywood's take on my career. We'll see what happens.
We've found something extraordinary. Extraordinary and disturbing, that is. You recall what you said about how polar melting might disrupt the North Atlantic current?
Yes.
Well, I think it's happening.
The government has to start making long-term preparations now.
Jack, all you have is a theory.
It's been raining like this for 3 days now.
Mr. Vice President, if we don't act now, it's going to be too late.
I'm afraid that time has come and gone, my friend.
What can we do?
Save as many as you can.
So that's Hollywood's take. The British scientists in a little hut in northern Scotland. And the American scientists got all the whizzy computers and new technology. But anyway, let's not worry about that too much. Slightly American-centric. But it's not just the film. You get this is actually from this April, Thursday the 12th of April. This was produced on the Independent website. Is the Gulf Stream about to collapse? And is the new ice age coming sooner than scientists think? So it's not just Hollywood, but there are serious publications. This is the BBC. Climate change dials down the Atlantic Ocean heating system. So the day after tomorrow, polar melting might disrupt the North Atlantic current. That's what the scientist says. Is that true? Fact or fiction? Should we be worried? And what will happen the day after tomorrow? So this is a very simplified schematic of the ocean circulation. It's by a guy called Wally Broker. It's called a conveyor belt. And what's happening is in the North Atlantic, warm water is coming north. And as the weather systems cross the Atlantic, they pick up moisture and heat, which is why we have our temperate winter climate. As the ocean loses heat, the water gets denser, it sinks and comes back as a cold current. So that's the sort of conveyor belt system. That's definitely happening. We know that from measurements. In a climate change scenario, if Greenland starts to melt, you put fresh water into the top of the Atlantic. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, so you get more rainfall. So again, putting more fresh water into the ocean. Fresh water is light, so you've got cooling, making the water dense and sinking, adding fresh water, making it light. If you add enough fresh water, you can actually disrupt that circulation because the water will not sink. So the conveyor belt could slow or stop. And that's what's happened in paleo data, we think. And the reason that's important to us, and I'm not sure how well this is going to come out, and this my pointer doesn't really work on this screen, unfortunately. If you look at a line of latitude where the UK is, you can see the UK in here. If you go around the line of latitude where the UK is at, if you go to North America or back into mainland Europe and Russia, they're about 10 degrees colder in the winter than we are. And that difference is because we have the Atlantic bringing warm water north and the weather systems picking up that heat, which gives us our temperate climate. This is for January 1993. If you look at any sort of January or February type picture, you'll find this is true. It's not January 1993, just one example. If we now look at the observed surface temperature change between 1901 and 2012, this is from the IPCC Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. You can see that the world has largely warmed. It's not warmed the same everywhere, but you can see there's this blue blob in the North Atlantic where it appears to have cooled over that period. So I want to make a point, because it's a thing I think people don't really understand or don't grasp as well as they should, is that cooling in our area doesn't mean that global warming isn't happening. So this is my simple example. If the northern hemisphere cools by 6 degrees, so minus 6 degrees, and the southern hemisphere warms by 10 degrees, 10 minus 6 is 4, two hemispheres divide by 2, so your average temperature change is 2 degrees. So everybody thinks a 2 degree temperature change over the next 100 years will be lovely. We can grow grapes in southern England and have wine viniculture and so on. It's not true. If you're in the minus 6 part, you will have a very different experience of a 2 degree average warming than if you're in the plus 10 part. So when I talk about things cooling, don't misunderstand me in thinking that somehow the whole planet will cool. It may cool locally. It won't necessarily cool globally. The 2 degree temperature rise is very differently experienced. And if we go back to this plot, you can see that even if there is cooling, it's not necessarily for the whole planet. So going back to the Atlantic Ocean, and this is again the simplified schematic, warm water going north, weather systems picking up heat, sinking. At 26 degrees north, 26 and a half degrees north, is the point at which most heat is going north. Beyond that point, the heat is being given up to the atmosphere. So we are making measurements at 26 north in the ocean to try and see whether this ocean circulation is changing and whether this scenario of slowing down or stopping is actually occurring. So I'm grateful to, so it's not just me, I mean, there's a whole raft of people doing this. I'm grateful to my colleagues at the Oceanography Centre and in the RAPID programme, which I run for some of the following materials. So this is done by, there's a lot of people involved in this, and so I'm very grateful for them for all these slides. So the traditional way of going to make these measurements is to take a ship, and the top line shows you the ship track from, I think it was the 2004 or maybe the 2010 measurements. Anyway, the point is you take a ship and you go across the Atlantic and stop every 50 kilometres and lower instruments to the bottom. That takes a long time. The ocean depth is about 5,000, 6,000 metres at its deepest point. So you lower the instruments, you measure temperature and salinity. From temperature and salinity, you can get pressure and density and other things. And that's a section across the Atlantic. It's not to scale horizontally relative to vertically, but it shows you the temperature structure. And that takes about 35 days. Now, if you want to monitor the current all the time, obviously you can't keep sending a ship backwards and forwards every 35 days. You tire out the scientists. It's extremely expensive. It's not a good way to go. And in fact, this is one of the best observed parts of the ocean in this way. It's been done in 57, 81, 92, 98, 2004, 2010, 2015. And that's not a lot in that period. So what we've done is we are doing it differently. We are deploying an array of moorings. So we make measurements from these moorings, which are basically a buoy, and with a weight at the bottom on a long wire, 5,000 metres in some cases. And we measure temperature and salinity from these things. We have them at the western boundary near Florida. We have them on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and at the eastern boundary. If the box was a nice rectangular box, the ocean, then it'd be easier, but it's slightly more complicated. And then we measure the Gulf Stream flowing through the Straits of Florida. Because the water is a conducting fluid and the Earth is a magnetic field, there's a telephone cable running across the Straits of Florida. So the flow of water through the magnetic field induces a voltage difference across the Straits of Florida, and we can measure that in the telephone cable. We're grateful to the telephone company for allowing us to stick voltage meters on either end of the cable. So basically, by combining these measurements, we can work out what's going on. And this is an example of what I call a tall mooring. It's to scale in the vertical, but the size of the buoys is not to scale. Obviously, they're much smaller. But the point to make is that this is 5 kilometres of wire, which we lay out behind the ship. I'll show you how that's done in a minute. And then the weight at the bottom, and compared to various things like the Empire State Building, the Eiffel Tower, and your house, which is this little dot. We have acoustic releases here at the bottom. Sound travels well in water, so it's all there in the water. We come back every 18 months. We send an acoustic ping. The acoustic release lets go of the weight and it all comes to the surface and we recover it. And we're using basically something that you're familiar with. If you watch your weather forecast, you have high pressures and low pressures. Fluid should flow from high pressure to low pressure. Because we're on a rotating planet, the flow is deflected at right angles. So the fluid, the winds, are along the isobars. The flow is at right angles. So you can measure the pressure difference. You can work out what the flow is. And that's essentially what we're doing in simple terms in the ocean. Temperature, salinity gives us density. Density gives us pressure. Pressure difference gives us flow. And it's been known by Ballot, I think it was 1918-something. I can't remember when it was, 200 years ago or something. If the wind is at your back, the low pressure is at your left. You know, people have known these sorts of things. So we're not doing anything very clever in terms of, you know, the physics we're doing is 19th century physics. So this is a little
is
video.
Is particularly sensitive to changes in temperature.
I'm not quite sure what's happened there. Didn't start at the beginning. Oops. Let's go back a minute. I don't know why that didn't start at the beginning.
The North Atlantic is particularly sensitive to changes in temperature and salinity. The circulation here is complex and known as the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. The circulation brings warm water towards northwestern Europe. As it does, it releases heat to the atmosphere. The heat transferred is equivalent to 1 million power stations and helps ensure Europe's temperate climate. As warm surface waters move north and cool, cold water returns south at depth, completing the circulation. Mount Tidy on the island of Tenerife, the highest point in the Atlantic Ocean. Scientists are on the island for the start of the Rapid Climate Change Expedition. They'll spend the next month deploying an array of 22 scientific moorings across the Atlantic between Africa and the tip of Miami. The instruments will measure the overturning circulation on a daily basis. Until this expedition, scientists had little idea how this circulation varied year on year, let alone every day. They sail along latitude 26.5 degrees north. This is where the ocean transports most heat northwards. Preparations are underway to deploy a mooring. Instruments and buoys are attached to cables that stream out behind the ship. This takes many hours.
I'll give you a shout when the first buoys are over.
Finally, they release the anchor. The equipment is dragged up to 5 kilometres down to the sea floor. The instruments will spend a year in unforgiving conditions. Deep beneath the ship, the instruments find anchorage on Africa's continental slope. The slopes give way to the abyssal plain. 3,000 kilometers ahead lies a vast mountain range, deep beneath the surface, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. The team deploy instruments on either side. Another 2,000 kilometres and the scientists reach the continental shelf of the United States. After deploying the array, the researchers return once more across the Atlantic. This time they stop every 50 kilometres and lower instruments to the seabed 5 kilometres below. This takes many hours. The instruments sample the water at different depths. Unlike the array deployed earlier, which will provide continuous daily measurements of the circulation, these instruments are hauled back to the surface once they've captured the various water samples. These samples provide a valuable reference point for the new array. This is only the fifth such transatlantic snapshot taken since 1957. After a year of constant operation, the scientists retrieve the instruments. This is a tense time. Will the instruments resurface as instructed? Or has a year under immense pressure proved too much? It sometimes takes a whole day to locate and retrieve a mooring.
A buoy about 50 metres starboard side towards the stern.
Scientists waste no time checking each instrument and recovering the valuable data. It's a success. Most instruments work perfectly. The team have now pieced together the first year's data. On the 17th of August 2007, the Rapid Climate Change Programme announced the first continuous daily measurements of the strength of the overturning circulation in two landmark papers in the American journal Science. It seems the circulation varies considerably from day to day, much more than expected. Policymakers and researchers are already using the results, and it has inspired educators and artists, writers and filmmakers.
So that's it's slightly dated because it was made early on in the programme, in about 2008, and it says we've done 5 transects, we've done some more now, but and also it says we do this once a year, but in fact we've gone over to 18 months as we've gained confidence in the robustness and the survivability of our instruments. We can leave them in the water for longer. So that's what we're doing in terms of measurements. And here are some results. So the first 10 years, 2004 to 2014, we started in 2004. The first few years looked really boring, which was a bit sad, in the sense that it's not been done before, so it was new. Nobody had ever seen this before. But we had a seasonal cycle and about an average circulation of what we measure in sverdrups, 18 sverdrups. A sverdrup is 1 million cubic metres of water per second. It's a lot of water. All the rivers... global discharge of water from rivers into the ocean is about 1 sverdrup. So this is a huge amount of water that's being moved by the North Atlantic, carrying a huge amount of heat. So we got to here, and then this was the surprise. We found this 30% decrease in 2009-10 winter. It recovered, and then we carried on measuring, and we found a decline over those first 10 years of measurements. Now that 30% decrease was a complete surprise. The seasonal changes is perhaps not surprising because temperatures change seasonally, the wind field changes, so you might expect a seasonal behaviour. But that dip was completely surprising. And it was also a very severe winter in the UK. The ocean circulation is not the complete explanation of this. This is a really interesting picture, 7th of January 2010. It's interesting for two reasons. One is that you can actually see the UK. Normally it's covered in cloud, so you wouldn't be able to get a satellite picture like this. And the second interesting thing is from the tip of Scotland to the tip of Cornwall, it is completely covered in snow. So there are other reasons why it was a particularly severe winter, but the ocean circulation was a contributory factor to change. The other thing, which this is not saying this is caused by the ocean circulation, but if the ocean circulation is not bringing heat northwards, it will stay further south in the Atlantic, which is the hurricane formation region. So you might expect if the circulation slows, then we might get stronger, more intense hurricanes because that heat is there to fuel the hurricanes. Another effect of the ocean circulation change, this is from a model, this is a sea level change, the change that you might expect. And as you can see, around the North Atlantic, you get changes possibly up to a metre in terms of sea level, particularly on the eastern seaboard of the USA. And in fact, in that 2009-10 winter, this is de-seasoned, but you can see that the dip in the circulation in red in 2009-10 led to a corresponding 13 centimetre change in sea level on the eastern seaboard of the USA. And that's a huge change, because when we talk about sea level changes for climate, we're talking about 3 millimetres a year, so a 13 centimetre change is huge. And they had some flooding as a result of that, and it recovered when the circulation recovered. So from these observations, we've had some surprises. We've seen some short-term changes which we didn't expect, which have some quite big impacts. But our observational record is too short to detect whether this trend is a long-term trend. And so here we have 13 years of data. So that was the first 10 years that I showed you before. We now got 13 years, and we found that happened. So is it doing that? Or is it possibly doing that? Some statistical analyses suggest it might be a change of state. You flip from one state to another, which systems can do. We're not sure. We need to keep observing. So, we're not going to get another ice age. That's Hollywood. It's not real. But global warming will continue to affect where the heat goes, and we could get local cooling and sea level rises around the North Atlantic due to these changes. I'm going to talk a bit more about what's happening now in broader sense, not just about the ocean, but more globally. The world is warming. This is global surface temperatures relative to 1951 to 1980. You can see that this trend is upwards. There was this claim there was a hiatus, or the temperature rise had stopped in the early 2000s. That was a load of rubbish. If you take a trend curve and put some wiggles on it, then you'll get that sort of behavior anyway, because there's other natural variability in the system. So the world is warming, and that's definitely happening. And the warmest years on record, which are listed here, 2016 has been the warmest year, but 2015, 2017, 2014, The only one that's not in the 2000s is 1998. Everything else is in the last, in this century. And 2016, you can see, this is 2016, how much warmer it was compared to 1961, 1990. And you can see again, there's the cooling blob in the North Atlantic, not entirely tied down as to what's going on. So that's one thing, that's heating. The ocean also absorbs carbon dioxide. In fact, 26% of the anthropogenic CO2, the stuff we're putting into the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels, goes into the ocean. 43% stays in the atmosphere, which leads to the warming and the terrestrial biosphere. So plants on land use the rest. And there are two measurements, two things going on with that CO2. There's the solubility pump. The CO2 simply goes into the water, is dissolved in the water, and that makes the water more acidic. And there's the biological pump. It gets dissolved in the water, and the plants, the algae in the water, use it just like plants on land use CO2. That's called the biological pump. But the solubility pump means that the ocean acidification, the pH, has decreased from 8.21 to 8.1 since pre-industrial times. That's not a linear scale, so that's actually a 25% increase in acidity. Hopefully this will work. Yeah. So we've been able to work out how much heat is going where. And as I said, the thermal capacity of water is much higher. 93% of the excess heat due to global warming is going into the ocean. And only 7% is leading to the effects that we feel, like glaciers melting and so on. So the ocean is really important. Ignore the graph. The point I want to make is that the temperatures affect things like the distribution of plankton and fish species, many of which are temperature sensitive. Warmer water in the tropics means hurricane formation regions. You can get stronger hurricanes, and you can, of course, change sea level. And this affects things like coral reefs. Not just water temperatures can lead to coral bleaching, but ocean acidification. Corals are composed of calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate dissolves in acid. And sea level rise. The top graph is more recent data from 92 to the present from satellites, we can measure the sea level change, and it's about 3 millimeters per year. If you go back in time, the bottom graph, which then extends back in time using tide gauges, it's probably been about 2 millimeters per year over the 20th century. But essentially, sea level is rising. Now, that may not seem much of a problem, but over a century, that would probably be about a meter, roughly, or something like that could be. And that would affect 10 million people. So in Bangladesh, about 10 million people live within 1 meter of sea level. And that's because it's a fertile area, and that's where they can get food. And actually, you know, even Nature, which is a major scientific publication, recently published an article about telltale warming likely to hit poorest countries first. These effects will be felt often by the world's poor in the first place. Another thing that's happening is that sea ice is disappearing. So in 2012, there was a particular minimum, I won't go into the graph, in September of that year. The orange curve on the sea ice plot on to your right is where the median sea ice extent was in September up to the year 2000, and the white is what the sea ice extent was in September 2012, which was the minimum that we've recorded so far. Although 2017 and 16 are also quite low values. And then, of course, ships can go through the Arctic, and that has all sorts of other consequences. And of course, you get headlines like this about being worried, because if the sea ice disappears, polar bears depend on sea ice for their lifestyle, hunting and existence. I'm not sure I've got time to do oceans and plastics. Maybe I'll skip through this fairly quickly. So everybody should know about this. If you watch Blue Planet 2, you know there's a problem with plastics in the ocean. You get these sort of iconic pictures, seahorse hanging onto a cotton bud, plastic cotton bud, or a turtle entangled in discarded fishing gear. Lots of fishing gear is discarded in the ocean because if it tangles up, they just cut it and leave it in the water. In fact, that messes with our moorings as well, because it gets tangled around our moorings, so it's extremely annoying. But it's probably more fatal for the turtle than for us. There's the famous plastic ducks. I don't know whether people have heard about this, but a container full of plastic ducks swept overboard in 1992 in the Pacific, and then they made a journey around the world's ocean. And in fact, I was interviewed a few years ago about ones that had actually made it into the North Atlantic through the Arctic. So these things can spread globally in terms of where they go. And we did some work, this is some work by a student of mine. We were asked about the four marine protected areas that the UK has abroad, not the ones near the UK, but there's Pitcairn, which is in the Pacific. There's South Georgia, which is in the South Atlantic. There's Ascension Island, which is in the tropical Atlantic. And there's the British Indian Ocean Territory. So they're the black areas outlined. So what we did is we took a computer model, and you can track backwards in a computer model where the water that arrives at that island comes from. And tracking backwards, the colours give you how many months it takes to get to that island. So, you know, within a year, stuff from land can reach all these marine protected areas. And in fact, the population density on the land shows that some of the stuff will come from places where there's lots of people. Now, it looks on that graph as if Pitcairn is fairly safe in the South Pacific, but that was only done over 12 months. When you go back and look at it over 10 years, stuff will get to Pitcairn. It may take longer than a year, but it will get there. And in fact, shortly after we published this paper, some colleagues in America published a paper with this picture in it. Henderson Island is one of the Pitcairn Island groups. And lo and behold, Henderson Island, which is probably the most isolated bit of the Pacific, is full of plastic. And we'll skip the garbage patch. The point about this is plastics degrades very slowly, hundreds of years, and it has serious consequences. The picture on the is of a copepod, which is a small zooplankton. The scientists had used luminous plastic to see whether it would ingest it, and it does indeed ingest it. You can see it inside because it's transparent. And this stuff is eaten by fish and plankton. We don't know exactly what the physiological effects long term are, and we eat fish, so it probably will be eating it eventually. So the putting plastics into the ocean is really problematic, and particularly microplastics, which are small pieces of plastic. And, you know, the UK government has just banned the use of microplastics, which is a great move. But these things are affecting the ocean. So I've talked a lot about the science, and let's talk about a bit of the Christian response or what the Christian view should be. And I talked about the God story and the Earth story, and I quite like this sort of picture of it, or how I think about it. You can see in Scripture, you go from creation in Genesis to new creation in Revelation, through the fall in Genesis 3, disobedient humanity, Israel in the Old Testament, God's people, Jesus' birth, death, and resurrection, the church, God's people in the New Testament, Jesus' return, true humanity restored. And it's good to think about what's happening in this large-scale picture, because God is interested in the whole of his creation. He's not just interested in us as human beings, he's interested in everything he's created. And in fact, you can see that if you go... before I go to the next scripture... So from a Christian perspective, what will happen the day after tomorrow is obviously what happens at the end of this story, which is the new creation. So eschatologically, the ultimate answer is there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. The question is, what should we be doing now? So God's plan, if you go to Romans 8 particularly, but there are other places that you can go to in the scriptures, God's plan is to rescue all of creation. It says creation itself will be set free from its slavery to decay. We know there are problems in creation, then there are problems with human beings. But it's clear that God's concern is both for us as human beings, but also for the planet. It's not just about getting people saved. It's about caring for all that he has created. And I think that's a question to us and a challenge to us is, in the light of that God cares for the whole of his creation, how then should we live? So when I think about this, I could give you lots of clever theology about the Old Testament, New Testament, views of creation, the land, and there's all sorts of interesting things you can do. But actually, what I like to do is to go back to something fairly simple. I like to go back to what Jesus said. Two commandments. We can all remember those, hopefully. And let me just explain why I think this speaks to us about God's creation. The first commandment is love God. Now, if I went over to Andrew here and said, have you got your mobile phone?
I haven't, I'm afraid.
You haven't? Have you got your iPad? Oh, yeah. All right. I'm going to borrow your iPad. And I'm going to stick it on the floor here, and I'm going to jump on it. Now, Andrew's a friend of mine. Now, if I did that, that's probably not a great expression of love and friendship. And we think about the earth. The earth is God's gift to us as human beings. But it says in Scripture, the earth is the Lord's. And I like these quotes from Christopher Wright, who's an Old Testament theologian. Trashing someone else's property is incompatible with any claim to love the other person. If I claim I'm Andrew's friend or I love Andrew, jumping up and down on his iPad is probably not a great way to express it. Jumping up and down on the earth, destroying the earth, is not a great way to express love towards God, who's our Father and Creator. And Christopher Wright says, our treatment of the earth will be a measure of our relationship with the Creator. I think those are very wise words. So point one, think about Jesus' first commandment, love God. If we love God, we want to love other people, we want to care for other people, we also want to care for God's creation. Jesus' second commandment is to love your neighbour as yourself. So, you know, are our actions causing harm to other people on the planet? And the answer is clearly yes. Our use of fossil fuels, particularly in the developed world, has led to global warming, and that's led to sea level rise, to droughts and to floods and all sorts of other consequences that we know are happening. And that is going to impact, like in Bangladesh, if the sea level goes up, it's the poor in Bangladesh that will suffer. In Africa, there are already droughts and things going on which we think are related to climate change. Sir John Horton, who's a Christian and who was the chair of the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change Working Group 1, said that, you know, climate change is a weapon of mass destruction. That's how he described it. We are actually destroying our fellow human beings by not facing up to these things. And from a Christian perspective, if you read the Bible says a lot about caring for the poor. Are we caring for the poor by our actions? How are we doing on that front? The aim of this is not to make people feel guilty, by the way. The aim of this is to say, if we love God, if we believe what Jesus told us about loving God and loving our neighbour, we should act on that. It should not be something that we ignore, but we should think about. So I'm not going to go and describe lots of things we could do. There is a myriad of books that tell you things you can do, like how to stop using plastics and how to cut your carbon dioxide emissions. But the two bottom line things to me are, if we want to stop ocean warming and ocean acidification and the consequences of that, then we need to cut our use of fossil fuels, gas, oil and coal. And there's no other way to do that. There's all sorts of people thinking about things you might do to get rid of CO2. But actually, the bottom line is we need to cut our CO2 emissions. That is actually a very challenging thing for us in the West, because it probably means that we might need to lead simpler lifestyles. And that is a challenge. It's certainly a challenge to me. And then with regard to ocean plastic pollution, we need to reduce our use of plastics and prevent them entering the ocean. Now, it might seem that giving up on carrier bags and the government banning microplastics is, you know, a good thing, which is great. But there's things like a lot of our clothing is basically plastic-based or has some plastic component. When you put it in the washing machine and it washes, little bits break off and they go into the sewage system, and a lot of that ends up in the ocean. So there are lots of other things that we need to think about beyond the sort of obvious. And those microplastics, you know, the big bits of plastic that I showed you on the beach, that's easy. You can send somebody along and they can pick them up. But the microplastics that are floating around in the ocean are not so easy to get rid of. And we've already put a lot of stuff in there. But that's the challenge, is to do those things. So for me, God's story and the Earth's story both present a challenge. As a scientist, the challenge to me is to understand what we're doing to the oceans and the planet, and that's what I work on, and how it's responding to human impacts, both to the carbon dioxide and to the plastics and the other things that we're doing. And then the second challenge is to live in a way that cares for both the people and the planet. I want to care for human beings, but I also want to care for God's creation, because that's part of what I believe he's called me to do. If I go right back to Genesis, I think, you know, God's command to Adam and Eve to till and care for the garden is a command to us to look after his world as well. So what should our response be? I'm not going to give you an answer. I think you need to think for yourself what your response is, because I'm not here to tell you what's right for you to do. I think I want you to make you think about what you might do, what might be right for you to do. The response won't necessarily be the same for everybody. For some people, it might mean a more drastic change in lifestyle. For others, it may not mean a huge change in lifestyle. I know people I've got friends who've completely given up on using plastics. I haven't got to that point myself. I find that quite a difficult concept, but they are now leading a completely plastic-free life, which I'm completely impressed by. Their determination and ability to do that, it just astounds me. I mean, I've tried to cut down on my use of plastics. I find it difficult to see how I can't use any plastic at all, but they're doing a great job, and I'm impressed by them. I'm not saying everybody should do that, but it's a good challenge to us that people can do these things. If you want to think about some of these things more, read the book. On sale, reduced price. And I just want to finish with this little video. Oh, there's no sound. Where's the sound gone? Why have I no sound? It's a bit odd. Let's try that again. Oh, that is very odd. Excuse me a minute. Let's see if something odd has happened. No, it should be on. According to that, it should be on. It's very odd. Maybe this won't work, so I apologise. It's a pity. It's a fun little video. It's two polar bears discussing human climate change. Anyway, I'm sorry about the video. Not sure why they didn't work. The other two did, but thank you very much for listening.
Well, thank you very much, Merrick. I had a pretty decent challenge at the end for all of us, I think. But questions? Anything that comes to mind? Raise your hand. Tina, do you want to...
Do you have a view on diesel versus petrol? Because
do I have a view on diesel versus petrol?
Because diesel cars are supposed to burn less CO2, or at least produce less CO2 per...
Yeah.
Because the engine burns it twice?
Yeah. But then I think in terms of CO2 emissions, they probably do have lower CO2 emissions, as I understand it. Unfortunately, they also emit a lot of other stuff, which is less than good. So I don't have a view in the sense of saying buy a diesel and not buy a petrol or vice versa, because I'm not sure either of them are particularly good for the environment, not necessarily for the same reason.
Anything else? Could you take the thing around? There's one just behind you, one over there. Okay, one behind first.
It's a very simple factual question. When I go shopping and I'm handed a plastic bag, I say, no, thank you, no plastic. And the answer is often, but this is biodegradable. And the question, and the answer I give usually is, I mean, I don't know because I'm not a scientist, but I'd like your answer. I usually say, but it still takes a long time to degrade. So what is the answer when the shopkeeper...
I don't know, because it depends what it's made out of, and I'm not sufficient of a chemist to without knowing the chemical composition of it, and say, I mean, I don't know. I think there are some things that degrade faster, but many plastics, even the biodegradable ones, take a time to degrade, I think. You know, not they don't sort of, like, disappear overnight. I'm not sure. It depends what it's made out of. I mean, we've got, at work, they've introduced biodegradable cups. Plastic, they're made out of vegetable matter, but... A colleague of mine has taken one and stuck it in the ground in her garden and is monitoring it to see how long it actually takes to biodegrade. So I'll tell you the answer when her experiment is concluded.
So you're saying if I'm wearing a nylon shirt, that's potentially creating microplastics that can go in the ocean?
Yeah, because when you wash it, little bits come off, fibres and so on, and they get washed down the plug hole. And they're small enough, some of them are small enough that they're not caught by filters. So then they go into the sewage, and most of the sewage eventually ends up in... A lot of this stuff is very small. But if you're a plankton that, you know, a few microns in size, a very small piece of plastic that you ingest, and then a lot of plankton ingest plastic, say, and then they're eaten by a fish, that will then concentrate it, and then we eat the fish. I mean, we don't really know what the long-term consequences are. We're doing a big-scale... experiment in the ocean with plastics which we don't really understand the consequences of. So, yeah.
There's one here. And then Gordon.
The answer, of course, is that when I go shopping, I always take an old bag with me.
That's a good thing to do.
Gordon over there, I think. Over there, Gordon.
I take no responsibility for comments made by the audience.
Of course, there are many people who are climate change deniers, and including Christians, and not wanting to cast any aspersions, but many of them in the other side of the Atlantic who are vehemently deny there's any such thing as climate change. And it's, I think, to coin a phrase, it's called fake news. But before asking you to comment, one of the things that struck me was, why can't people actually see rationally see the argument? And I've been reading a book, and I always go back to it, by Daniel Kahneman, called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. And in Thinking Fast, you come to a conclusion based on your gut reactions, and then heaven and earth will not change it, in a sense. It's that simplistic. But can you comment on this climate change denial, but especially among some Christians?
Yeah. So I think you're right in that there is a gut reaction. I mean, I've read the same book by Daniel Kahneman, so I know the sort of theoretical idea behind that. I do think that does happen to a lot of people. I think the reality is, in the States, there's a group of neoconservatives who, over many years, have denied that tobacco caused cancer, that acid rain was due to sulfur emissions from power stations, that tobacco caused secondary smoking caused cancer. I can't remember. There's a whole list of them. There's a book. Yeah. Well, lots of those sorts of things. But there's an interesting book by Naomi Oreskes called Merchants of Doubt, which basically shows how that approach has been used, because they are opposed to the idea of any regulation of what they do. And they've been very good at selling those ideas to the public. And also, there's a much more polarized situation politically between the Democrats and Democrats and the Republicans in the States. And because people like Al Gore, who's a Democrat, were saying climate change was a problem, many Republicans can react against that. And unfortunately, a lot of white evangelical Christians in the States are actually very Republican in their views, and therefore it's very polarized in the way it isn't in this country. The other thing is that I think if you pick away, so I should talk to you about the hiatus briefly. When we got that little slowdown in the temperature rise in the early 2000s, which has now disappeared and we're going back up again, which everybody who's done any science would understand that would happen anyway, climate change deniers picked on that and said, oh, you're all wrong, your models didn't quite show this blip, which is true, the models didn't catch that. Models are not perfect, but they did catch the overall trend, but they didn't catch that little flattening out. And so they said, oh, well, clearly climate change is not happening, you've got it all wrong. But actually, the glaciers were still melting, the sea level, all the other indicators, apart from that one indicator, were still showing that climate change. So what they do, the deniers tend to pick on little bits of the science. And if you pick any particular little bit, you can always cast doubt. So they cast doubt, and that's why this book, The Merchants of Doubt, is really, really important, because what they're doing is they're not able to show the science is wrong. They cast doubt on bits of science. And once you cast a doubt in a person's mind, it's a bit like in Genesis 3, the serpent says to Eve, did God say, does the science prove, does the science say this or that or the other? So, it's a very complex area. But I think you're right. Me coming and giving rational arguments, it will not necessarily win over hearts and minds for some people. I think the things are much more gut reactions. But I think in America, they're fueled by this lobby, neoconservative lobby, which are actually casting doubts about lots of these issues.
There's one there.
Now, I just wanted to add to that, because if they are these very literal Bible people, maybe they just think the new heaven and the new earth is coming anyway, and so we don't have to worry about any of it. That is my feeling about how they justify that position.
That's true. I think that's a very cogent observation, in the sense that I think there is a strand of theological thinking in the States, particularly premillennial type thinking, where they think the earth is going to be burnt up anyway, and therefore it doesn't matter. I mean, I actually heard somebody say from a pulpit once many years ago, not recently, but probably 15 years ago or longer, oh, well, I just dump the rubbish in my backyard, the earth is going to be burnt up, it doesn't really matter what happens, so we shouldn't care for the earth. There's problems with scriptural interpretation. I won't go into it in a lot of detail, but for example, it's saying 2 Peter, where it talks about some of these things. If you actually read those passages carefully, they seem to be more about purifying and cleansing. So burning up is not necessarily destroying. It's more about purifying and cleansing, like the flood. I think it parallels the purifying and cleansing with the flood. The flood didn't destroy the earth. It purified it, got rid of all the violence. That's, if you actually go back and look, God was not very happy with the way people were treating or behaving. So a lot of those pictures can actually be interpreted in terms of purifying rather than destroying. So if you think about the new heavens and the earth as this heaven and earth being purified, then you get a different picture, and caring for it becomes more important. So I think, you know, there's different...
Dominion over the animals, that's the other thing, isn't it? God gave us dominion over the animals, so it doesn't matter if they're all becoming extinct.
Well, there is that issue, yes, yeah. People do interpret that as well, and I question that interpretation of Genesis. I think if you think about rule and dominion... our example, particularly as Christians, is Jesus. Jesus as king. Jesus as king came to serve, not to destroy. Jesus came to serve. And kingship in the Old Testament, if you look at the requirements for the king in, say, Deuteronomy, I think it's Deuteronomy 18 or somewhere around there, they describe what the king should be like. The sort of rule that's envisaged is not one where you have dominion in the sense of just telling people what to do, destroying things. You're there to make good things happen. So,
one there, Lucy.
Right, sorry. I've been hearing a lot recently about how there might be a 10-year delay between the emissions of CO2 and the actual visual impact on, say, the climate change and the global temperature. I was wondering if you were seeing the same kind of delay in the emissions of CO2 and the effect on the oceans, or whether that was more of a kind of effect on the air, and whether the effects were more immediate.
Well, that's a complicated question to answer in simple terms, because lots of feedback systems in the climate. So if you change this, this changes and so on, so there's feedbacks. So, for example, with the ocean circulation, some of the changes we are seeing in the deep ocean may have been caused years before, because by the time the water gets into the deep ocean, it takes several years for it to propagate down from the surface and down the deep ocean and so on. So there are time delays in. I'm not sure about the 10 years without knowing exactly what that was about. I can't comment on that. But certainly there are delays in the system, so not all impacts are necessarily immediate, and that's certainly true. Trying to understand those is why we use climate models to try and unpick what's happening. There is a consequence in the sense that CO2 stays in the atmosphere for a long time, so even if we stop using CO2 or putting CO2 into the atmosphere today, sea level would still continue to rise, and air temperatures would continue to rise for many years yet before they flattened out, because the CO2 would stay in the atmosphere that we've already put there. So there are time delays, you're right, but it's a complex system because things interact, so it's not easy to give you like a nice, neat answer.
There's another one behind there.
Yeah, so can I just ask a bit more about microplastics? Because you said the government have banned microplastics.
Well, they've banned microbeads, I think is the technical.
Beads, yeah. So, yeah. Oh, right, okay. Because I was reading in National Geographic that the guy who termed microplastics is that all plastics break down into microplastics. Yeah, yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Ah, right, so we can't actually ban them.
You can't ban them, no. They've banned microbeads, which are essentially microplastics, but they come in things like cosmetics and things you don't really need to use.
Like plastic. Scrubs.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So you don't need to use... So yeah, my terminology was incorrect. They banned microbeads.
Oh, sorry.
So that's my fault. I should have got the terminology right.
And with clothes, is it just nylon that's plastic?
Or? Well, I don't know. Any man-made fibre.
Any man-made fibre.
I think most man-made fibres have a plastic base. I'm not sufficient of a chemist or an expert on clothing to give you an answer to that. But I know things like that.
But is there anything you can do with the washing machine? I thought you could... Can you get like a bag, like a guppy bag
Well, there are filters and things, but I think the point is that if you get these very small particles, they get through the filters. I don't know enough about... I'm an oceanographer, not a plastics expert, so you're asking me at a level that I'm not sure I can give you sensible answers. But I do know that clothing fibres break down, man-made fibres, and that can get into the ocean, and that's the key issue. The details of that, I think some of the filtering systems just don't, because they're so small, they don't get filtered out. And although for us they're tiny and irrelevant, if you're a plankton on a sort of, you know, tiny scale, that's actually quite a big thing that you're ingesting.
One at the back there.
I think in response to your question, just over there, that you can get a bag called a Guppy Friend, and it captures, you put all your man-made clothes into that bag and it captures the fibres and you remove them and put them in the bin instead of letting them wash through. So it's called Guppy Friend and they have a website.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. You know more about it than I do.
I was in St. Petersburg recently. I noticed that there was a friend of mine I was staying with. They don't do any recycling. And sort of one of the sort of messages that I'm drawing from what you're saying is that recycling isn't the big thing really anymore. It's actually stop using these things. So are we saying that that's not a problem for the future of the planet? We've still got to encourage that? And
I think
the
recycling
countries that don't do it at all, enormous countries like
I think
China.
Recycling is a good thing. I mean, I think we're never going to get to the point where we don't use any plastics at all, which is, you know, I think that's... There are things that plastics are extremely useful for. I mean, if you think about some of the things that go on in hospitals and medicines, you know, you'd have difficulty replacing them if you didn't use plastic products. So I don't think we'll ever get to that point. I think, like plastic milk bottles can be melted down and remade into milk bottles. So I think recycling is a good thing anyway. Until we can cut down our use, we may as well recycle what we do have. So it's better to recycle it than just throw it away. But longer term is probably to try and cut our use of plastics. I mean, there's multiple reasons for that. One, not least because the oil and stuff that plastic is made out of, the reserves are not infinite. So, you know, if you want future generations to be able to take advantage of some plastics where it's absolutely necessary and useful to make a plastic product, say in a medical context, then we want to leave that for future generations. So I think recycling is a good thing, but cutting down... You know, I was just thinking about it the other day. I was actually thinking about it when I was younger. You know, we used to have a milkman who would come with milk bottles, and you know, you'd put your milk bottle out and he would take it away and they would wash it and clean it and it would be recycled. And that was all done all the time. And whereas now we go to the supermarket and buy these big plastic containers, which up till fairly recently we just junked. There's a bit of me that wants to go back to the 1950s and 60s, but that's possibly just my age.
Right, we're going to have Arnold here, then there's one here and one here.
As an old friend of Merrick's, have you seen the film Plastic Ocean, produced by the Institute of Environmental Studies? It is doing the rounds a little bit, not on the public cinemas. It answers many of these questions about plastics. Yeah. And for those of you who have Netflix, it's available on Netflix. It's called Plastic Ocean, and it's well worth seeing.
Okay, thank you very much, Arnold. That's helpful.
Just taking devil's advocate for a bit.
Feel free.
Perhaps a bigger question. Is there, first part, is there any evidence that God designed the Earth to be highly resilient? You talk about lots of feedback systems that are really, really complex. I don't know whether you believe that God designed the Earth or whether you believe it just arise out of random and chance occurrences or not. But have you seen any evidence for a design? And if it is designed, could it actually be that we're panicking over nothing, that God is actually a lot more clever than we are, and that the Earth is actually resilient to anything we can throw at it? Okay. Just a possibility.
Okay. So I don't think you can look for evidence of design in a direct sense. I think there are pointers. I think, for example, the whole... issue of particular the particular numbers in physics, constants, that if you change the constants, the world as it is now wouldn't exist. The pointers to some sort of design. Fred Hoyle, who discovered how carbon was formed in stars, said it looks like some super intelligent being has tampered with the laws of physics to make this happen. So none of these things are proofs of God's design, but they are pointers that God might have done these things, or somebody has done. I mean, Fred Hoyle called it a superintelligent being, but to me that would be God. So the point is, I think looking for design in the sense of proof of God's existence in through physics or biology or anything is a mistake, because science changes. So for example, the intelligent design movement was very hot on the flagellum as being something that couldn't naturally occur. And therefore, God must have done something. And then scientists come along and explain how it came about naturally, and then you've got a hole in your argument. So I think using those sorts of design arguments is very iffy because of the you know, if science then explains it away, you've explained away God. I don't like that sort of idea. So I think I wouldn't look for that. Now, going to the resilience question, I have no idea whether God designed the world to be resilient. The current view of that is the Gaia theory, which is not to do with God particularly, but the idea that the Earth is a self-correcting system that allows life to exist. Now, that theory is great and may have some truth to it, although there's a lot of discussion about that. The problem with it is the theory says that life will exist. It doesn't say human life will exist. So the planet may be resilient in the sense of life will continue to exist, but, you know, we may not be here. You know, I don't know. Well, actually, the life on this planet, I mean, bacteria win. I mean, there's more bacteria than anything else on the planet. So, in fact, I can't remember what percentage of us is bacteria. The microbiome that we possess is huge. So, I don't know. I don't think we've got any evidence that the planet is resilient in some ultimate
sense. Can I just come in? Because I think there is, if you like, the CO2. Plants grow faster with more CO2 and when it's warmer.
Yeah.
So they can compensate to a limited extent.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you go back into the high CO2 times, millions of years ago, the plant life was pretty phenomenal.
But there were no human beings.
So I think it is resilient, but we're pushing it beyond its natural resilience. Yeah. I think that would what I would feel. Yeah. There's a question in the front here.
Thank you. In the Book of Revelation, prior to the new heaven and new earth, what is described is a system under Satan and his Antichrist, which indicates some methods of extreme rigorous control over all trading processes and commerce of every kind. I think you're probably familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
Without which no man may buy nor sell, and so on. That's part one of what I wanted to say. The next part I would say is for people to look back at something called the technocracy movement, which existed and then was latterly developed, partly a lot under the funding of the Rockefeller family. And the technocracy movement, one of the things it sought to do was to equate directly the economic transactions with energetic content in order to most closely control everything. And for energetic content, one might also talk about carbon-involving reactions, which are most of the energetic processes. And I think there's an entirely different way of looking at what you've been talking about, which is that seeking to control carbon and describe things under carbon transactions and carbon transfers is actually part of a building up towards the very control system, rigorous and rigid control system that Revelations describes as run by Satan's Antichrist.
Right. I'm afraid I don't want to get into a discussion of the meaning of Revelation in detail, because I think Revelation is an extremely difficult book to understand. I mean, to me, the Revelation... So the thing that helped me to understand Revelation most was years ago somebody told me this story. A bunch of students in a seminary in the States were studying Revelation and were really struggling to get to grips with it. So they went down to the basketball court and to play basketball to get a bit of a break from their studies. And they saw this caretaker sitting in the corner and he was reading his Bible. And they went across and said, "What are you reading?" He said, "I'm reading Revelation." And they said, "Don't you find that difficult to understand?" He said, "No, it's very simple, really. Jesus wins in the end." And so my view of Revelation is a bit like that. You know, I'm not sure I understand the details, and I don't want to get into a discussion of the details because I think there's multiple interpretations of Revelation. But to me, the story of Revelation is Jesus wins in the end, and I'm comfortable with that interpretation. I'm not scared by Satan because Jesus wins in the end. I'm not worried about what's actually going on. You know, I have hope for the future because Jesus wins in the end. I have a belief that irrespective of whether your view of that is correct or not, and I don't know, Jesus wins in the end, and that gives me hope both for the future of myself, you guys in the room, and for the planet.
So any more? You've had one, and I've got one over here. I think we haven't had one yet.
I was just going to ask, what are the big questions left in oceanography and climate change? What's kind of the big question trying to be answered at the moment?
Obviously one question we're trying to answer is the rapid climate change problem, so that's one question. Another question is how you deal with the plastics in the ocean and what the long-term effects are of their ingestion by plankton and fish and all the rest of it and into the food chain. Hurricane formation, how does that link with changes in the ocean circulation and the impacts that might have in places in America, but also more probably in a place like the Philippines and the poorer countries. Sea level rise is a big issue because the sea level is not rising at 3 millimetres everywhere. In some places it's rising faster, in other places it's rising slower, and that's because of the ocean circulation. So although we know, it's a bit like the average temperature thing, we know 3 millimetres per year global sea level rise, but if it's 10 millimetres here and 1 millimetre here, your experience of what that will do to your little island, particularly some of the Pacific islands and other places, it will differ. So we're trying to understand, a lot of what we're trying to do at the moment is understand the regional effects. So we've got pretty good grasp of the global implications, 2 degrees over 100 years, 3 millimetres per year over the next 100 years. But what does that mean if you're living in, London in terms of sea level rise? Do you need to worry about how big the Thames Barrier has to be? Or if you're living in Bangladesh, how fast is the sea level going to rise in Bangladesh? So we're working a lot on issues to do with regional issues, because I think that's where it more impacts human beings.
And do you think there's a way, we're still going up with the CO2 and we're trying to stop it going up, but is there any way it can come down again? Is there anything that we as ingenious human beings should be thinking about or not?
Well, there's a lot of thought going into what's called geoengineering. And so there's two types of geoengineering: solar radiation management and carbon dioxide removal. Solar radiation management is things like putting mirrors in space that will reflect sunlight, so the Earth won't warm as fast because the sunlight won't be coming to the Earth. Or things like spraying water droplets, which have got salt in them, into the atmosphere to create more clouds. More clouds increases the Earth's albedo, it reflects more sun. So that's solar radiation management is one sort of approach. Another sort of approach is carbon dioxide removal, and there are various techniques for that, which I'm not that familiar with in terms of the details. One technique was to put iron into the ocean, because in some places plankton don't grow because they're short of iron. So people have done experiments. If you put iron in, you get more plankton growth. Plankton use CO2. They take that out of the water, so more CO2 is absorbed from the atmosphere. There are other CO2 removal issues. One of the problems with the plankton growth one is we don't know what the long-term ecological consequences. So that's as a short-term thing. You might take CO2 out, but what that will do to the ecosystem long-term, nobody knows. Another one is growing trees, and that does work. If you grow a tree, when a tree is young and it's growing fast, it takes a lot of carbon dioxide to build bulk. But once they become mature, they become carbon neutral, in the sense they're not using carbon dioxide in the same way. So there's lots of all these ideas around. I'm not sure there's a single magic bullet. I think the danger is that we think that somehow there'll be a single solution. I quite like, there's a guy called Sokolov, I think it's called Sokolov, or I can't remember, who wrote a paper a few years ago and came up with this idea, which are called Sokolov wedges. It's like a pie. Now, you've got this problem where you want to get rid of all this stuff, pie, so you chop it up. So, if we do a bit about housing, you can build carbon neutral housing. We can do that now. We have the technology to do that. We don't. We could do. It probably adds about £15,000 to the price of a new house. And the government could force all new housing to be carbon neutral. We could do that. We can all go for electric cars or smaller cars that's another one. More efficient transport, like with ships. So there's a whole load of different things. So he basically said, we're never going to find a single solution, but if we do all these different things, we can eventually get rid of the problem. And that's, I think, is the approach we have to do. So everything that we do that helps. So anything helps in that sense. Insulate your house, turn down the thermostat. There's one thing that's like slightly worrying is the air conditioning problem. So the world gets warmer, you turn up your air conditioning because you're too hot. Of course, air conditioning requires power. That puts more CO2 into the atmosphere, so your world gets even warmer, so you turn up your air conditioning. So that's what's called a not a very good feedback loop. So yeah. We need to think about these things.
Now, I think we ought really to let Merrick off the hook. He's been going great guns for a long time. And I'm sure you'll hang around for a bit if anybody has got any personal questions. So, Merrick, thank you very much indeed for illuminating us, educating us, and challenging us, I think, this evening. So let's give Merrick a round of applause.